Chapter 16. David. I am walking the halls. Students are shouting and high-fiving, slamming lockers and sucking up sugared phosphoric acid from aluminum cans balanced on top of new textbooks. They stream past me on both sides, yelling into cell phones as though this was not a high school but a small stock exchange amid a sudden collapse in the futures market. I am bumped and jostled and redirected. I am a fish, a salmon swimming upstream, back to the place of my birth, where I was hatched into the waters of my education. They are all rushing past me, headed for open sea, and I am coming back to die in the place where it all began. Bertrand J. Wilson High School. And yet, I am not coming back. This is the stream I never left. The bell rings. The hallway empties. Students are sucked into closing doorways. I am left to walk alone with the image of Bully the Bulldog affirming my suspension from atop the desk of Principal Robert B. Robertson III. Bob. This is not my place, the hallway. I should be on the other side of one of those doors, cajoling students into ending their phone calls so that the learning can begin. The gray lockers stretch out into the distance on either side of the hallway. They feel eerily like soldiers standing at attention, separated by bayoneted rifles, watching me warily, lined up against the wall to protect the precious imbeciles on the other side of the doors from the pedophile in the hallway. I don't know where to go or what to do in my new status. The investigated, the suspended, the accused. What would Hester Prynne do? I head instinctively for the teacher's lounge where I have stashed my lunch. Five or six teachers are here, talking. They look up as I enter, and I ignore them, heading for the refrigerator. They resume, something about Arnold Schwarzenegger. The refrigerator is jammed with paper lunch bags. I examine each of them at least three times, deciphering the scribbled, uneven names, looking for my familiar black scrawl, before I realize that mine is not among them. Someone has eaten my lunch. I repack the fridge and slam the door a little too hard, again disrupting the convention. Ken Phillips bellows at me from across the lounge.
Hey, Dave, two questions. Does an amendment to the Constitution have to be passed by 2/3 or 3/4 of the states? And would the Arnold for President Amendment be the 27th or the 28th Amendment?
Ken poses these questions while looking significantly at the teachers assembled around him. Clearly, some sort of bet is on.
There is no Arnold for President Amendment, Ken.
You know what I mean.
Yeah, I do, but that's not the amendment. That's the only reason anybody voted for the bill. You're just anti-Arnold.
The others laugh at Kenny the Card.
I don't know, Ken, I say, heading for the door. You've been a citizen for 20 years and managed the 8th largest economy in the world, responsible for fully 13% of the nation's gross domestic product. Maybe you should be able to run for president.
Right, but it's for Arnold, Dave. You know that, right?
Yeah, I know that.
I thought you were a Dem,
he says, snottily, like he is holding me to a confession of regularly peeing the bed.
I didn't say I liked him, Ken. I just don't want to be deprived of an opportunity to vote against him. It's my right as a citizen.
I fling open the door to the hall. Ken shouts to stop me at the threshold, and I do, like his voice is some sort of leash.
So it's the 27th Amendment, then?
28th.
Was it 2/3 of the states?
I splay the fingers on my right hand so he can count them. Article 5, Ken. As long as you remember that if it works for Arnold, it works for Madeleine Albright. And if it works for Austrians, it works for Mexicans. I am back out into the hall, and the door is slowly closing on the sound of Ken Phillips trying to save face. Since he is our government teacher, this will not be easy. I'm alone again with the fact of my suspension. I laugh out loud in disbelief. The very thought of being suspended from my job
my job. Out of some ridiculous suspicion that I am somehow responsible for Brittany Klein not coming home to mommy is so alien to me. So fucking preposterous that the thought has nowhere to go inside my head. It circles and circles until ramming itself into my now swollen and bruised sense of irony. Shep. I must see Shep. I walk resolutely back toward and then past Principal Bob's office, past the library and the cafeteria, down to the science end of the building. I peer through the square of wire lattice glass embedded in the door of the biology lab. Shep is across the room holding an anatomical chart of a chicken over his chest. Mr. Shepherd is pointing to parts of the chicken. Mr. Shepherd is pointing to students and answering questions. Mr. Shepherd is making a joke and a ridiculous face. There is the sharp sound of laughter and youthful merriment pressing firmly against the door like carbonation against a cork. Mr. Shepherd sees my face and heads in my direction. "What's up, man?" he whispers, the class behind him quiet and straining to hear. "We gotta talk, Shep."
"Can't do that, Dave."
"What?"
"Shep, I've just been suspended."
He grimaced.
"Bastard! He said he wouldn't."
"Who, Robertson?"
"Yeah, Dave."
He looked cagily over his shoulder into his classroom.
"I can't talk to you, man. I'm sorry. Strict instructions. If I discuss this shit with you, I'm fired."
"They can't do that."
"They can and they will, and I do not want to lose my job."
My face feels hot. I can feel sweat along the hairline at the top of my neck.
"You what? Now you don't want to lose your job? Now, Shep? Where was that concern at Billy Rock's? Where was that concern for your job when you were out there getting your groove on?"
Shep slips out into the hall and closes the door.
"What, now you're a stickler for law and order and protocol?" "Look, dude, you need to chill out. You're not going to lose your job, and I'm not going to lose my job. Okay?
Shep."
"Okay, Dave?"
He is much taller than I am, and I find his body imposing, as much for its perfection as for its size.
"Calm down. She'll turn up, okay?"
He stoops and looks at me directly, arching his brows in a gesture of hope, an expression of reason, looking for permission to exist.
"Okay? And if you don't know where she is, then I'm sure she's someplace safe and she'll come home, okay?" "What do you mean if I don't know where she is? Of course I don't know." "Okay, okay, Dave. Sheesh."
"What did you tell them, Shep?"
"I gotta go, Dave."
"God damn it, Shep."
"Dave, I told them everything that happened. You should do the same. They're gonna look into it, and they're gonna do what they're gonna do, okay, dude? I have no control over that, okay? I'm sure everything will be fine. So, you know, peace out. Go home."
He clamps his hand down on my shoulder and gives it a mighty squeeze.
"I gotta get back in there. Go home, Dave." "Wait, a paid suspension?"
I blink up at him.
"Yeah?" "Fuck, dude."
He swats me across the chest.
"Take a paid vacation."
The door closes in my face, and I can hear Mr. Shepherd repressurizing the room with questions about nature's preferred ratio of cocks to hens. I storm off toward the exit, my head filled with violent, moving images that randomly feature Shep and Bob and Brittany Klein and lots of panicked chickens, feathers everywhere, as I push forcefully through the double doors into an explosion of sunlight. I am almost to the parking lot before I realize that my briefcase is still in the classroom. I resolve to leave it and to let them worry about what to do with it. Let them worry about having to call me to tell me I left it behind, and about having to store it in a safe place, and about whether to allow me special dispensation to step onto school grounds for the purpose of retrieving it. But this is a bad idea. The briefcase is a gift from my brother, purchased by my mother, but handed to me by Ben upon receiving my teaching license. Abandoning it to any uncertain fate is enough to empty what's left of my spirit. I re-enter the building and head back down the hallway. The phalanx of lockers stiffens at my unexpected return. I peer into the classroom, my classroom, to find Principal Bob pacing up and down the aisle of desks. He grooms his tie and nods as someone out of view is speaking. I start to knock, but then resent so powerfully the idea that I need permission to enter this room that I simply turn the knob and push. 31 heads rotate in my direction. I wave politely, apologetically, stupidly, like I am a lost parent looking for the nearest bathroom.
Mr. Johns, Principal Bob booms from the back. What can we do for you?
He looks at his watch, which is his not-so-subtle way of telling me that he expected me off school property some time ago. Briefcase? I reply, pointing toward the desk. There is a rising intonation in my voice, as though I need permission to answer his question. I hate myself.
By all means, he says, then forges on. Good answer, Mr. Wettig. You are correct. The Nina, the Pinta, and the Santa Maria. And why do you think that it is with Christopher Columbus that we start our study of American history?
I traverse the front of the room to the desk and find the briefcase where I had left it, tucked into the back of the chairwell. I pull the chair back, resisting an urge to sit down and let Bulldog Bob sweat at the prospect of having to throw me out of the room, kicking and screaming, and treating these kids to a front-row lesson in civil disobedience.
Mr. Barlow, why Columbus?
Because he basically discovered it?
Good. Christopher Columbus discovered North America, and although he was an Italian explorer sailing for...
who? Spain?
Right, sailing for King Ferdinand II and Queen Isabella of Spain, Christopher Columbus landed on the island he was to call San Salvador, this speck of land glistening and gleaming out in the Caribbean. And when he did that, little did he know that he was to become our first American hero, hundreds of years before the United States of America was even born.
Something else we can do for you there, Mr. Johns?
I am standing behind the desk, staring at him, dumbfounded. And his question catches me by surprise. I'm relieved that my mouth is closed.
No thanks, I say, holding up the briefcase. I got it.
Good. Have a nice day.
I wave reflexively, then jerk my hand violently out of the air in a second thought that is far too late. Principal Bob does not acknowledge the gesture, but smiles slightly to acknowledge its inadvertence.
So, you will learn about a lot of American heroes in this class. That's really the great thing about history. But you have to start with the person who put America on the map in the first place. Because without Columbus, there's no connection between the old Europe and the new Americas. No trade, no development, no settlement, no investment, no growth. The United States as we know it may not even exist. Ladies and gents, you are getting your fine education in the Columbus City School District. We named our city after that man. You see, Christopher Columbus...
The door closes, severing the bulldog's words. I stand in the empty hallway, now more sickened and incredulous than I am angry, wishing that words were a kind of physical appendage, and that the act of closing a door in the middle of a sentence was a crude but effective amputation. Another explosion of sunlight and I am back outside, making for the faculty parking lot like I am motivated by some high and noble purpose, like I have something urgent and important to do. I have nowhere to go and nothing to do, but my gait and my posture lie about this all the way to the car. I am almost able to squeal my tires as I leave, but the engine is not up to it, and my crappy little Civic takes its leave politely and in fuel-efficient contrition for any disruption. I head west, no idea where I'm going, but going there very fast and angrily. My first thought is to talk with my parents, which is an instinctive response. My second thought is that my parents will not help matters, which is a learned response. I anticipate my mother's distraction with Tilly's party, then her overconsumption of concern with what other people will think if my suspension is picked up by the newspapers. Local teacher, son of Susan and Hollis Johns, photo at left, suspended in connection with teen's disappearance. thinking in such terms as my mother's learned response, a byproduct of the shell shock that is so frequently accompanied by the flesh-toned visage of my sister in checkout lines beneath coy, unflattering headlines. I will be lectured on the wisdom of going to Billy Rock's in the first place. She will warn me never to take Ben to such places. She will actually ask me if I took Ben to Billy Rock's that night I snuck him out the back window. She will ricochet furiously between being too distracted to give my little worries much genuine attention to being so overcome with concern about the social fallout from my sudden infamy to offer me any helpful perspective. My father, meanwhile, will offer me ample perspective, more than enough to mask his own harsh judgment on the quality of my judgment, failing to do any justice to my emotions at being wrongly accused, suspended, and subjected to police inquiry. He will pour a glass of wine and take me down to his study where he can insulate us from the pedestrian worries of my mother. He will display his erudition by placing my current debacle into some cosmic scheme of things. His advice will sound ancient and Eastern and will have a disturbingly psychoanalytic aftertaste. He will show neither anger nor sorrow on my behalf, and he will distinguish his advice from that of my mother by encouraging me to leave the emotional responses to those with undisciplined intellects and shallow temperaments. Worse, he will generously offer to underwrite my life, again, if I decide to get out of teaching altogether and try something else, preferably in the area of finance or law, anything that will test what he imagines is my true, albeit squandered, potential. No, I think to myself, it is enough that I am unmarried and childless, that I do not golf or fish, that I am indifferent to the caliber of company that he keeps, that I am unmoved by his dabbling enthusiasm for the esoteric, that I have no investments, no savings, and a constitutional antipathy for a balanced checkbook, that I am a lowly high school history teacher, driving a crappy car and living in a crappy condominium that he paid for in exchange for a note that I have never honored and that he knew I would never honor. All that is enough. Hollis Johns does not need yet another opportunity to restrain the swell of disappointment in his eldest child. There is a half hour of aimless driving, circles within circles, worries within worries, anger emerging from confusion and slipping sideways into incredulity, before I decide to go to consult with my union representative. I have been to union headquarters only once, and I have to search, winding around the city without much of a clue, except for a vague, edificial picture in my head. I am using all of my windows, looking for anything that might trigger a directional memory. I'm like a child lost at the county fair, looking up at the faces of tall strangers. It seems that people are staring. They look at me as I pass like they know the answers I do not. Like everyone but me knows that I am a danger to society. As though Principal Bob had traveled these streets just moments before, with a bullhorn. A police car is two cars behind me and I fleetingly wonder if I am being followed. I think of Principal Bob having to hold off normal district protocol while the police investigate. The police? I'm being investigated by the fucking police? At the corner, a trio of suits waiting to cross the street stop their conversation and mark my passing. It is my imagination, I know, but I want to flip them off anyway. I want to tell them they know nothing about me and to stop judging me in a vacuum. I find the CEA building, just as I remembered it, but a different color. There is a knot of brightly dressed women descending the steps. They stop and glower at me as I drive around looking for a space, scolding me with their eyes and their secret knowledge and their ill-informed opinions about me. I don't know how they know. They just do. The woman at the reception desk of the Columbus Education Association does not give me any looks. I'm vaguely relieved at this until it is clear that she does not plan on looking at me, ever. She is younger, 20s, with a seated posture that might have suggested scoliosis in someone 60 years older. She is looking at a single sheet of paper that she holds in front of her face with two fingers. She is chewing gum in slow, rhythmic squishes, as though this is the way one properly speaks to a piece of paper.
"Excuse me," I say with just a hint of irritation. Her eyes roll sideways and regard me with an opacity that makes me think I have interrupted some sort of fugue or micro-seizure. I am instantly interested in trying a hard slap across the face. "Hi there, I'm a teacher over at Wilson. I've just been suspended." She blinks at me, sets down the paper, and fishes through a file drawer. Her phone rings. In a display of multitasking I would have not thought possible, she rummages through another file as she explains to someone named Maggie that someone named Gretchen is still sick and that someone named Rick needs to stay home to watch someone named Little Dylan, and that just because Rick thinks he is so important...
"Hold on a sec, Maggie," she says into the phone, swiveling in my direction. "Here's a copy of the current contract, and this..." "No, Maggie, hold on, I'm not talking to you. This is a step one grievance form. Unless the grievance involves any of these issues listed down here..."
Her nail is pink with a blue star on the tip.
"The union will not grieve the matter on your behalf."
"It won't?"
"Step two is the first point of union involvement. Even then, you know, it really depends. Come see us when you get a response to step one." "Thanks, Mags. Rick's dreaming if he thinks he can just..." "Yes?"
"I'd like to see..." I'm fishing through my wallet for the guy's name. The guy who is supposed to be personally offended at anything the Columbus City School District does to interfere with my rights as a teacher. The guy whose religion is to protect the Union of Ohio Educators, and whose mission is to make sure my dues are working for me. Warren Bunce. Is he around?
"Nope. Thursday's his golf day."
"You're kidding."
"What's your name?"
"David Johns." She scribbles on the piece of paper with which she was initially so involved. I see now that it is a facsimile of a takeout menu from a place called Scooters.
"Okay, we've got your number on file. I'll tell him to call you." "Maggie, I really could give a shit what he says, okay? He's the one who pissed and moaned for visitation. I don't want to hear his side of the story. I'm not interested in his side of..."
I return to the car, tossing the papers on top of my briefcase and slamming the door. Now what? I have an urge to unload on someone who will understand. I want to be the insensitive asshole who obsesses to others about his own problems. If only May had not left, it would finally be my turn. I flip through the union contract, looking idly at the headings. Article 1.1, Union Dues. 2.8, Agency Fees. 3.2, Arbitration. 4.4, Length of School Day. 4.7, Teacher Conferences. Hoping perhaps to find something that tells me where I should drive next. Food. Food is where I should drive next. There is no heading or subheading that says Article 11.9, artery-clogging slop you know you shouldn't eat. But because it's golf day for Warren Bunce, and because someone stole my damn lunch, and because I want to eat something before I'm prosecuted for whatever, that is where I'm going. There is a line at the drive-thru. Six cars up, a man in a green minivan is ordering food for six spastic, bobbing heads. I change my mind, but now a cab is behind me. People look at me as I wait. A woman in shorts and a yellow baseball hat and a windbreaker that says something about sailing steps over the concrete barrier that defines the drive-thru and walks in front of the car. She is on a shortcut to the front door. She is making that fearful, wary connection with my eyes. Fingertips are outstretched toward the hood. She does not want me to run her over. That is now precisely what I want to do. I turn on the radio instead, smiling and waving her across to put her at ease. For reasons that have eluded me for the past 3 months, the FM band in my Cadillac of tuna cans is on the blink. My choices of audio entertainment are AM or compact discs, of which I have none that I've heard less than 10 billion times.
"But you know me. That's, no spin. It's no spin. What can I tell you, Walt? You want spin? You want a bunch of nonsense to make you feel better about yourself? Hey, then that's fine, but you gotta go someplace else. Cause, my friend, you're not getting it here. The fact is that these protesters are pushing an agenda of anti-nationalism. America is big, and it is powerful, and it is free, and therefore it is always wrong and evil and tyrannical around the world. That's the agenda, and I'm not buying it, man. I ain't buying it. Ever. Ever. And the left hates.
There are watery driblets of ketchup on Article 3.1 of the agreement between the Columbus Board of Education and the Columbus Education Association. I turn the driblets into smears with my thumb where it says that I have 10 days to submit my Step 1 grievance to Principal Bob. I'm parked one empty space away from an ambulance that is not an ambulance. An oversized white van with all the telltale orange striping and a rack for the lights and siren, but with the word ambulance, along with the lights and siren, missing. A woman is behind the wheel eating French fries and looking at me. I project onto her a suspicion that I have done something horrible to Brittany Klein, and a dark musing that perhaps a suspension with pay is not enough for someone like me. She smiles a little pitifully, and it occurs to me that she might not understand that I am sucking ketchup off my thumb. I search for a napkin, suddenly wanting to be home where I cannot project my predicament onto the faces of strangers. I resume looking for contract language that might explain how I can bypass Principal Bob as the decision maker on my step one, but find none. The faux ambulance comes to life and pulls away, turning in front of my car, and then around to the other side so that the driver's windows line up. The woman's head is down and she is doing something in her lap, beneath the window frame. She has a plain face and sandy brown hair, pulled back into a barrette. I lower my window, and she smiles a little down into her lap before she looks at me, still doing whatever she's doing.
"You don't look so bad to me," she says,
finally looking up and out of her window. Her face, her little quirk of a smile, says that she knows the answer, but I'll be damned if I know the question. I'm wondering if she's going to give me a napkin. I wipe my mouth with a thumb and forefinger. "Excuse me?" She sticks her hand out the window. It is a napkin. I reach out and take it from her. The words Macmillan Auto Body are scribbled in roomy blue loops across one side, followed by a Cleveland address and phone number.
"Mac will give you a good deal on a paint job. Tell him Sissy sent you, and he'll knock off a few more bucks. Good luck."
"Hey," she grins and raises her eyebrows at me.
"It's got to get better sometime."
The hand that once held the napkin is now up in a static wave, and the van pulls away. I watch in my mirror as she leaves the parking lot, merges, and disappears. It's got to get better sometime. I am perplexed with who she was and what she meant, and whether it is in fact true that it's got to get better sometime. Does it? Does it really? I ponder the napkin. Of course it does, I think. It sure as hell can't get much worse. I look in my mirror and back down at the napkin and back in the mirror, and I laugh. I laugh at the fact that a complete stranger, one I had prejudged no less, has given me the encouragement and perspective that I have needed all day. Good luck. It's got to get better sometime. Of course it does. I haven't done anything. I'm in the middle of a mistake stacked upon a misunderstanding, and she's absolutely right. It has to get better sometime. Brittany will turn up. Principal Bob will give me some shit about never really believing I was a problem but needing to follow procedure. May will cool off and come home. Why am I so quick to live in the heart of the worst-case scenario? Why do I assume responsibility that is not mine to assume? This is masochism, not optimism. My chest expands and issues something close to a sigh of relief. Another look in the mirror at the place where the non-ambulance left the parking lot. Of course it has to get better. Get a grip already.
I bag up the dregs of my lunch, toss the contract on the passenger seat on top of the Step 1 grievance form, suck down the last of my soda, and head for home with a renewed sense of calm. The window is open and my hand plays airplane in the unseasonably warm September air, sunlight glinting off my hood. Shep says I should take a vacation, and that is what I will do. Paid time off. How bad is that? People are looking and I am ignoring, no longer inclined to assume their disdain. My slowly inflating spirit has got me thinking more concretely of May, and of how much I miss her, and of how, when she returns, I will show her the epitome of patience and acceptance and love. How I will not judge her rashness or her temper. How I will apologize for my part in the breakup. How I will show her my openness to marriage. It's got to get better sometime. Damn straight it does. I think of May's legs and her hair, and her perfect breasts, and her skin that is like silk, and I can feel a surge that is the vascular equivalent of optimism. In fact, I will take the initiative. I will take the first step. I will call her tonight when she is home from work, and I will tell her that she belongs with me and I with her. That I am tired of emptiness. That I am sorry. She will reject me at first. She will make sounds of disbelief and disgust. She will hang up. But it will loosen the jar. It will get her to thinking. And she will realize that I am right. And from there, it will be a simple matter of saving face, of returning with dignity. Which will be easier than she thinks because I will not judge her. I will not withhold myself from her just to make a point. I will not insinuate with my eyes that she is shallow, that she is beneath me in some way, because she is not beneath me. She is simply different, and I am too intolerant of that difference. Or, at least, I was intolerant. Knowing your faults is more than half the battle. I am more able to accept May on her own terms now that I have been forced to think about things. God, I can be such a jerk sometimes. I will apologize. Sincerely. Emasculation is not required, but authenticity is required. If she is angry, then I will receive her anger until it is spent, and we will begin. I turn onto my street and see a car in my driveway. My heart throws in an extra beat, knowing that it is May, back at home, waiting to start again, as though my new epiphanous musings have conjured her from another dimension. But it's not May. The dark blue Chevy sedan in my driveway resembles May's car only in the sense that it has four tires and some windows. I pull in as a man in dress slacks and a denim shirt and a black leather jacket is returning to the driveway from my front door. He is putting on glasses but stops in his tracks when he sees me, returning the shades to his shirt pocket. "David Johns?" he asks. I climb out and close the door. He is barrel-chested with thickly muscled arms and black hair so straight and short it looks painted onto his scalp. "Yes?" "I'm Detective North with the Columbus Police Department." He pulls a badge from his pocket and I pretend to inspect. My brain has slipped its gears and my mouth is dry. I swallow. "What seems to be the trouble, officer?" I actually say this to him. My brain has, for lack of any current operative intelligence, defaulted to old television dialogue. "Well, I think you probably know exactly what the trouble is, Mr. Johns," he says wryly, somehow managing to maintain his official by-the-book air. I feel his words and his eyes somewhere in the center of my chest. May is fond of telling me that I have a problem with over-responsibility. "Not everything bad in the world is your fault, David," she will say in a philosophically self-evident tone that accompanies her fingertips on my cheek or her lips on my forehead. All of this on the rare occasions that she is not upset at me about something that she thinks is my fault and that I should feel very guilty about. "Brittany Klein?" I ask, like some game show contestant with a level of uncertainty that even I do not find credible. "Brittany Klein, you have spoken with Principal Robertson." "Yes, suspended until this is cleared up." I cross and then uncross my arms and look up the street, wondering what people are imagining about this driveway conversation.
and knowing that I am a shit for holding the same what-will-the-neighbors-think impulse against my mother as a fatal character flaw.
"That's up to the school," he says. "We just need to conduct our investigation. I'd like to ask you some questions about your involvement with Miss Klein."
May is right about the over-responsibility thing. I suspect that I am one of those self-hating liberals so decried on Mike O'Donnell's The Fixture. A secular Catholic. My first impulse in the shadow of any disciplinary authority is usually to conclude that I must be guilty of something, that I am in the path of responsibility, which comes not as an arrow or a bullet, but as a flood covering everything, soaking everything, making escape impossible. This guilty impulse leads, as if at random, either to urges in the direction of evasion or to urges in the direction of expiation, all of which I try mightily to suppress, which, not surprisingly, tends to make me look, well, guilty.
I don't have any involvement with Brittany Klein. I mean, well, I do, you know, have involvement with her in the sense that I'm, you know, her teacher. So I know her, but I'm not involved with her, not involved, or anything like that.
Detective North crosses his arms and exhales, looking at me hard. I do not like the silence and try to fill it with undisciplined words. I mean, I know she's missing or that, you know, she hasn't been home in a couple of days or so, but I don't know where she is. I mean, I haven't seen her or talked to her, so I don't know what I can tell you.
So then you've never had any extracurricular social involvement with Brittany Klein. Is that what you're telling me?
No, I mean, that's not what I'm telling you, because there was some involvement one night earlier this week, but that was just once at a club. It wasn't involvement like romantic involvement. It was just talking and dancing and...
Mr. Johns, why don't we go inside and talk about this?
Detective North turns and heads for the door, leaving me in the driveway to stare at shoulders that seem wider than the entrance to my home. I know my rights, and I know what he's up to. He wants inside to snoop. He wants to poke around at my invitation, where he has no legal right to be. Well, he can go fuck himself, and I won't say another word without a lawyer. He turns and looks back at me, smiling and relaxed.
"Can you believe this weather?"
he asks, genially, gesturing to the sky.
"It's like summer is never going to end."
All I can do is nod with my hands on my hips, making my agreement about the weather seem emphatic.
"Yeah, just an awesome summer. You sail, Dave?"
"Great. Now I'm Dave."
"No,"
I answer, suspiciously, imagining Brittany's mutilated corpse in the hull of some sailboat he has not told me about.
"Oh, you really ought to try it. Nothing quite like a day out on the lakes. Sunlight on the water, a little breeze to fill the sail."
We stare at each other for a long moment, door to driveway. "Mr. Johns, let's get this done and I'll be on my way. Just a few questions." It is the retightening of his voice that pulls me forward, as though he had slackened his demeanor just so he can have the benefit of another stiff yank. I leave the driveway along with what I know is my last clear opportunity to assert my constitutional objection. But I have done nothing wrong. I have nothing to hide from this man who simply has a job to do. I can make this difficult and cast suspicion upon myself, or I can cooperate and send him on his way with a minimum of complication. For the sake of my ingrained need to appease those with the power to punish, I am bargaining with my principles and my better judgment. Something in this sickens me. Detective North ambulates through my living room, kitchen, bedroom, spare bedroom pretending to be a den,
as though he were strolling through a park on a Sunday afternoon,
hands clasped behind his back, bending at the waist to look at low-lying curiosities, like the clutter on the top of my dresser and my fish tank, and the wastebasket in the bathroom. Looking, but not touching. Lips pursed as though in a silent whistle. He pauses for a moment at the cluster of matted photographs of me and May, at the Columbus Day Parade, at the zoo in front of the lion habitat, on her father's sailboat. Shit. With the sunlight on the water and a little breeze to fill the fucking sail.
"I thought you said you didn't sail."
"That was one afternoon on someone else's boat."
"Nice-looking woman,"
he says, sounding impressed,
like he might be inclined to think differently of me. Like it is suddenly less plausible that I might have designs on a teenage schoolgirl.
Yours?
Yeah, I say, heading for the kitchen. You want something to drink? Because I want my interrogators to feel welcome and refreshed and well hydrated.
Thanks, Dave. A glass of water would be great.
What's her name?
May? We've been seeing each other a long time.
He gives a grunt and a soft, appreciative whistle. Cameras have a way with May.
So you're pretty close, huh?
Yeah, we're comfortable together. I cannot fathom why I'm lying except for the disconcerting possibility that I am so shallow as to actually care what Detective North of the Columbus Police Department thinks of my ability to keep and hold a beautiful woman. It is a competitive male thing. Or it could be that I am the son of my parents and I am a slave to a genetic equation that defines one's human worth as merely the sum of what one owns, what one knows, and who one knows, all multiplied by what one has objectively accomplished in life and the number of other people in the community who have a working appreciation for the values of these various components. It is a kind of sickness that leads to a lifelong compulsion to pad the equation. Unlike my father, who has accomplished much in his life, I have accomplished almost nothing. And I own little more than what I can purchase on a teacher's salary. That leaves what I know, which I like to think is greater than average, and who I know, which is May. Beautiful, brown, luxuriously mouth-watering May. Somewhere in my subconscious, I suspect that I am simply fighting to keep her in the equation, inflating my worth, compensating for my impecunious existence and lack of achievement. I suspect it is not lost on me, down in the cellar where I keep score, that the more serious our romance, the more May adds to both my who I know and what I own categories. I am shamelessly double-counting.
Boy, I'd snap her up, Dave. Don't let that one get away.
We'll get married soon, I'm sure.
Engaged?
Not yet.
Pop the question, Dave. Just do it, man. She lives here?
Yeah, most of the time, but she has her own place up in Bellevue. He is at the tank again, peering from all angles, stooping and squatting and bending to get a view behind the seaweed.
I used to have fish when I was a kid. That's a betta, right?
I hand him his glass of water.
So's that one. Australian rainbow, cichlid, loach, tetra.
I head for the living room, tired of the pet detective bullshit.
Brittany's been missing, what, 2 or 3 days now? Isn't a police investigation a little premature?
I sit in the recliner, forcing the big detective to take a low, sagging couch so that his knees will tower above his ass. Only he chooses not to sit at all, continuing to walk the room, pacing in slow, deliberate steps. The floorboards beneath my carpet creak and groan beneath his weight. He ignores my question.
Tell me about Billy Rocks, Dave.
I went to meet a friend, a colleague.
Who?
Shep. I mean, Mark Shepard. He goes by Shep. He's a teacher at Wilson.
And?
And while we were there, we ran into Brittany and one of her friends, Carmen.
Last name?
No idea.
Same school?
Yes.
So, what happened?
Nothing. We talked. We danced one dance, and I left.
Who danced?
The three of us.
You and Brittany and Carmen.
Right.
Was Shep dancing?
Not with me.
Okay, so you danced a dance and you left.
Right.
You knew they were underage, right?
Yes.
So why did you dance with them?
I don't know. They pulled me out there. I didn't even stay a whole song.
You like dancing, do you?
No, not really.
I assumed you must.
They asked.
You were being nice.
I was being nice.
Were they drinking?
No. Yes, I don't really know. They were drinking something, but Shep seemed to think it was just like soda or something.
Have you seen Brittany or Carmen since that night?
No.
Did you and Brittany leave together?
No. You didn't drive her home?
No.
You didn't give her a lift to a friend's house?
No.
Last I saw her was at Billy Rock's. I told her I wanted her and Carmen to go home and I left. And that's the last I saw her.
Maybe she needed a ride because she didn't have a car and you were just being nice again.
No harm in being nice, Dave.
I did not take her anywhere. I left her at Billy Rock's.
What was she wearing?
White skirt and a top, I think. She was pretty, you know. Tarted up.
Tarted up.
Yeah, you know, all sexy.
You thought she was sexy?
His eyebrows are raised. I have piqued his interest.
Me?
No, I didn't.
That's what you just said, isn't it?
No, I'm just saying she was dressed provocatively, you know, to get attention.
But you didn't find them sexy.
Not even a little. Is that right?
That's right.
Since that evening, has Brittany contacted you?
No.
A phone call? A note?
No, nothing.
She was not in class?
No.
Have you asked around?
I asked one of her friends where she was, but she didn't seem to know.
Why were you asking?
Because I was concerned that she wasn't in class.
Have you spoken to anyone else about your night at Billy Rock's?
No.
No one.
No.
Not even Mr. Shepherd.
No.
How often do you go to Billy Rock's?
Like maybe less than a dozen times in my whole life.
Detective North is towering over me as I sit in my little leather recliner. He pours the water down his throat, swallows once, and hands me the glass.
Dave, I'm going to level with you here. My sister is Brittany's mother. I've got one very concerned and upset family on my hands. My sister, Brittany's mother, is a police dispatcher. That means the whole department is interested in this one. Okay?
Now, yeah, you're right. It is a little early to start assuming the worst. But better too early than too late. We're all hoping she turns up with a good explanation. But in the meantime, I'm spending my vacation shaking bushes and looking under rocks. Got me?
I nod, still holding the glass as though I have been frozen in place.
So let me ask you this, and then I will get out of your house. Do you have any idea? Any idea at all? I don't care how far-fetched it sounds, how crazy, how unbelievable, or how bad it may make you look. Do you have any idea where this girl might be?
I raise my other hand and swear on his empty water glass.
I honestly have no idea, officer. No idea. I hope you find her safe.
Officer North drills me with his eyes, gauging my sincerity.
Okay then, Dave. Appreciate the water.
He slaps me hard on the shoulder, then pulls me out of the chair as I shake his hand. I'll leave you this card, and I want you to call me if you learn anything at all.
Will do, I say, taking his business card.
I realize that I have made way too much of this from the beginning, scolding myself for all of the unnecessary worry and anger and drama, congratulating myself on having decided to cooperate rather than object on principle, pleased at having honestly responded to his questions without overindulging him with details that would have only served to complicate the fact of my innocence. I follow him to the front door, thank him, wave, another farewell. He is gone. I feel lighter, relieved at the sudden restoration of perspective. I consider returning immediately to school to talk to Bulldog Bob, but know that will be useless until the administrative process has worked its course. T's must be crossed, I's must be dotted. In the meantime, I will take my paid vacation. I will work on lesson plans. I will rekindle things with May. Wash the tub. Clean out the... The telephone rings.
David, what are you doing home? I was going to leave a message.
I didn't feel well, Mom.
Are you okay?
Yes, just a little stomach flu or something. I feel better already, really. I just didn't want to risk spreading it around the school. I'll be fine by tomorrow.
Are you sure?
I'm fine, Mom. What's up?
Is May sick, too?
Well, yes. Yes, she hasn't been feeling well. I probably got it from her.
You're coming to the party, right? You will be at this party.
Oh, God, I keep forgetting. Yeah, I'll be there.
Forgetting? May's bringing a casserole, isn't she?
I don't know, Mom. Maybe you should assume the worst. She really hasn't felt up to cooking.
Can I talk to her?
She's not here. She's staying at her place. Look, I'll bring something, okay?
You don't cook, David. That's one of my failings as a mother, never teaching you to cook. Is everything okay between you and May?
What? Yeah, fine.
No trouble I should know about?
No, we're fine. I can pick something up and bring it.
It's not that kind of party, David. It's a celebration for Tilly.
It's a conference call.
I'm not serving takeout food. What would people think?
They'd think... never mind. Fine, no takeout. Why did you call?
What do you mean? To tell you to call me so I would know what May is going to make.
Oh, well, sorry for the inconvenience.
It's not inconvenient, David. I just need to know. Ben, just a minute, David. Sweetheart, let me see that towel. Where are you going with this Superman? Are you my Superman today? There you go. Wait. There you go. No running, please. Ben is helping me with the towels today.
Ah, towel duty.
It's not inconvenient, David. May can come or not come. I don't care.
Mom.
Maybe she doesn't want to come.
She's sick, Mom. That's all. If she doesn't come, it will be because she's sick.
David, I don't really care. I'm fine with whatever. She can come or not. I just need to know about the dinner because it's all up to me. You understand that, right? It's certainly not up to your father. If this comes together, it will be because I make it come together. So whatever May wants to do is just fine. I hope she feels better and all that. I know she's never really liked your sister anyway.
Mom.
That's not a bad thing. I just know that she would probably rather not spend a whole lot of time...
Mom.
...cooking and, you know, showing up.
Mom.
Yes?
Nothing.
There's no reason to be upset, David. I just need to know about dinner.
I'm not upset, Mom. What is it you want me to do about dinner? I'm not going to cook anything, and you won't let me pick anything up, so...
It's not a matter of not letting you, David. You don't have to say it like that. It's just not that kind of party. I'll think of something. It's up to me anyway. If I ask your father for help, he'll tell me this is all my deal. That's his favorite saying these days. It's all your deal, Susan.
Ask him to grill something. He likes grilling.
No, I'm not going down that road anymore. Your father and that grill and a glass of wine or two or three are a bad, B-A-D combination. I mean B-A...
I can spell bad, Mom.
He's getting so...
What?
Remote. He's just very cold. He walks around in his own little world like I don't exist. I made him breakfast this morning and he just turned and walked out of the kitchen. I threw it all out. I'm very sweet. I'm very loving. I say, good morning, Hollis. How did you sleep, Hollis? Are you feeling okay today, Hollis? I greet him with a smile and a pat on the arm and... He looks at me like I don't exist, and he just smiles and walks out. Just like that. Not a goodbye or a smile or anything. He's just off for the day.
Off where?
I don't know. Shirt and tie. He gave me some story. Going somewhere to help a friend, interview for something. I don't know. I'm not sure I believe him, frankly. If you want to know the absolute truth of the matter, I don't know where he was going. I don't really care. I just can't take being so excluded. Being left. Left behind. You know?
Yeah,
It's very cold in this house, David. I don't know if you really understand that because you're never here, but it's very cold. Very distant. I feel like I'm suffocating. Indifference is suffocating. When I say suffocating, do you know what I'm getting at?
A loud knocking thuds down the hall to my rescue. Yeah, look, Mom, there's someone at the door. I gotta go. What time do you want me over there on Saturday?
Oh, well, 6:30. No running, Ben. Thank you.
Okay, and you've got the dinner thing under control?
Well, let's think about it. Let's play it by ear. Bye, David.
I thought you were going to take care of it.
What?
I thought you were going to take care of dinner and that I'm not bringing...
Well, I am, but let's just think about it. Bye.
Mom, what the hell does that mean? What? Mom? Mom? I clench my jaw and can feel my pulse beating in my temples. I'm magically back to feeling angry at the world. At the fucking world. Not at my mother, no, no. At the world, in general. Because my mother is never deserving of anger or irritation. Only sympathy. That is as low as my feelings can legitimately reach. I cannot tell if I'm angry that she is hurting, or angry that I am helpless to help her, or angry that she sees nothing of her own role in her own misery, or angry that she says these things about my father, or angry that those things are true, or angry that she thinks nothing of my peace of mind, or angry that I have abandoned Ben to the misery of that house, or angry that I do not have Tilly's strength to tell my parents off, and that I so easily resort to wheedling appeasements. Or angry that I'm not a better son in her time of need. Or ever. I want to do violent things to my phone. The off beep is supremely unsatisfying. I slam the cordless receiver down on the kitchen counter just as there is another barrage of knocks that rattles the photos in the hallway. I wish I had a large caliber weapon like a surface-to-air missile that I could fire down the hallway, through the door, and directly into the chest of the person on the other side. Mr. Johns. It's him again. He's wearing his glasses. Oh, yes? Did you forget something? Will you come with me, please? I follow him to the driveway, where he stands between his car and mine. Apparently, he has never left. He points to the passenger side of my Civic. The letters are large and sloppy and bright red, like fresh animal blood dripping toward the driveway. Rapist. I am speechless and can only stare. When did this happen? I don't know. I had no idea. I mean, I've been driving around. I had no idea. It's the passenger side, so I shit. My car. Any idea who might have done this, Mr. Johns? No. Any idea why someone sprayed the word rapist on your car? No. A little odd, don't you think? I kneel down and pull my thumb across the T. Very dry. Do you think it might be friends of Brittany Klein who think you had something to do with her disappearance? People who knew you had a relationship? I did not have a relationship with Brittany Klein. Do you think it could have been Brittany herself who wrote this? I have no idea. Would Brittany have any reason to write something like that? No. Mr. Johns, can you tell me what that is? He is pointing his substantial finger, the one that identified my rainbow fish a long time ago, back when I was Dave, directly into the window of the passenger door, which I now notice is not completely closed. What? That. The finger stiffens. It is pointing to a red makeup bag poking out from beneath the passenger seat. It is in the very place I had stuffed it just before kidnapping my brother and secreting him off to Fantasia. I do not answer the question. Will you open the car door, Mr. Johns? We are here again. At the intersection of my life and the U.S. Constitution. I don't have to do that, I say, not looking at him. A black and white squad car pulls into my driveway. No, you don't, says Detective North, but I can have a warrant here in about 20 minutes. He takes off his stupid shades and slips them into his pocket. He is my friend again. Look, Dave. Things are going to go a lot easier for you if you cooperate. You understand what I'm telling you. I'm not talking to you anymore without a lawyer. Fine. Consent to a search and we can talk later when you have a lawyer. I know it's useless to resist the search. It will only make me look worse. Fucking Shep. Fucking Brittany Klein. I let out an exasperated sigh and gesture in mock magnanimity. In the direction of my despoiled Civic. North dons a pair of white latex gloves, and I remove myself in disgust to the top of the driveway. The cop in the uniform, a lanky blonde beanpole of a thing, quickly positions himself between me and my front door. He does not want me to barricade myself in my home, or search for a weapon, or take hostages, or kill myself, all of which now strike me as tragically missed opportunities. But then, I am new to the role of felony suspect. North has the bag in his hand. He is poking inside with two of his white latex fingers. When he is done, he looks at me with a face I cannot read. He gives a nod, and Officer Beanpole moves in, pulling my hands behind me, ratcheting down the metal cuffs, patting my pockets and ankles, reciting to me from Miranda versus Arizona. It is as they are folding me carefully into the back of the squad car, guarding my head like the soft skull of an infant, protecting the city of Columbus from concussion liability and trumped-up brutality charges, that I wonder if she was right after all. If things really do gotta get better sometime.